Okay. Well, it really is very nice to be here. I was sort of thinking on the drive down here today, you know, where to begin. And I guess the place to begin is with the fact that we are winding up the work on the 16-volume Dietrich Bonhoeffer Works translation project. I'm currently working on the index volume, which feels like it's going to take me forever, but having finished the other books, I know that this one, too, will get done. And as we've been, you know, sort of in this end phase, the question kind of is, you know, what comes next? You know, don't we sort of, at this point, know everything there is to know? We certainly have more than enough documents. But as I've thought about it, I think that this is a good time to think about the fact that I think we really are entering a new era in Bonhoeffer research and perhaps Bonhoeffer understanding. Part of that has to do with the completion of the works. The fact that they're now available in English, they've been available for about 20 years in German, of course. So there really is a lot of documentation here that people are not that familiar with. The final volume that came out last fall was volume 14. The volumes did not appear in sequence. And that's the volume that deals with the Finkenwalde years from 1935 to 1937. And there was a lot in that volume that I was not familiar with. There were a lot of documents in that volume that, you know, have not been translated before, that are not that commonly known. You know, there are some writings of Bonhoeffer that everybody knows, everybody's read. But there's a lot of stuff in the works that really is relatively unknown, and yet rather significant in understanding his development. And I felt, once I got through the Finkenwalde volume, that I needed to go back and completely reread Discipleship, because that the Finkenwalde documents gave me new insights into the book that he had written. And so I think that there is now material there for people to really delve into Bonhoeffer sort of up close, day by day, and that in turn will lead to some new readings of Bonhoeffer. The other, you know, obvious reason why we're entering a new era is that there really is a shift in generations at this point. Eberhard Beke, Bonhoeffer's friend and biographer, died about 14 years ago in 2000. The generation of German scholars who studied with him or sort of lived and worked in that immediate post-war period have passed from the scene. And even in terms of the editorial staff and the people who worked on the English translation volumes, most of them are now retired. Some of the people who worked on our series have died since the publications began. So, you know, that the first one or two generations of Bonhoeffer scholars who really, I think, definitively shaped in many ways our readings of key Bonhoeffer texts are passing from the scene. And, you know, it's your turn. I mean, there are new generations coming in who I think also bring different questions and different insights to what he wrote. And I think we can see that in the kinds of books that have been coming out in the past couple of years. There's a broad scope of Bonhoeffer interpretation. It's just as broad as his appeal. And one of the interesting things about Bonhoeffer has always been that he really does appeal to people on all points of the Christian theological spectrum. So you have evangelicals who really embrace him. You have liberal Protestants. You have sort of mainline church members. You know, everybody finds something in Bonhoeffer that they find very meaningful, that they find very relevant for their own understanding of their faith. And of course, then, you know, works are created on that basis. So that I think, you know, that's part of the reason why there's a new era. And at the same time, I think that there's some real barriers to our stepping outside what I'm describing as the Bonhoeffer box and really looking at him in a new way. And one of the big barriers is the sheer quantity of this, I can't even lift it, this biography, and the 16-volume works. Eberhard Beke, who wrote this biography, who was the literary executor of Bonhoeffer's his writings, who sort of was behind the creation of the 16-volume works, really did write a magisterial, definitive biography that traces his personal life story, the story of the family, the story of his theological development, the political context in which he lived. You know, there's a lot in here that is just amazing. And so there's so much there, and there's so much in the works, that I think people assume that that's it, that what we have in the 16 volume works in this combined really sort of tells us what we need to know. And the only thing that is left to do is to sort of reread things and come up with new interpretations or new meanings. Sort of like having a horse that knows the way. The Bonhoeffer or the Bacon narrative of the Bonhoeffer story is so well worn. It's such a well worn path that everybody kind of follows that path. And one of the things that has struck me whenever I've read a new book about Bonhoeffer or seen one of the films, whether it's a fictional presentation such as Denise Jardina's book, some years ago called Saints and Villains, or the Metaxas biography, every story of his life kind of follows the Bacon narrative, because that's the narrative we have, and it's so well known that it's hard to think outside of that. So one of the things that I had your class members read, and I don't know if people have had a chance to read it because I sort of got it too late, I sent around two essays. One was written by a British historian named Andrew Chandler about 10 years ago called The Quest for the Historical Bonhoeffer. And I'm telling everybody I know who teaches Bonhoeffer to make sure their students read that essay, because it's an absolutely brilliant essay. Chandler is a very solid historian. He wrote a wonderful book some years ago called Brethren in Adversity about George Bell. He oversees the Bell Archives, so he's very familiar with the history of the British churches. But Andrew's point, and he actually, this was a review essay, and what he was reviewing were the German Dietrich Bonhoeffer Werke. And his point in reviewing the Werke was what I just said. There's so much here. Everybody has retold this story so many times that there's a real danger of people sort of getting caught in a certain historiographical groove, and not really being able to see that there might be other perspectives. And one of the things that Chandler notes, and it's one of the things I'm going to focus on this afternoon, there are a lot of people mentioned in the biography, people whom Bonhoeffer encountered in Berlin, part of his studies, and Bacon sort of connected the dots as he saw them. But one of the things you realize when you really do historiographical research are that some of these people who in the biography seem to be minor players, they got one or two entries in the index, turn out to be very important individuals in other contexts during this era. And that in turn sheds some light on their connection to Bonhoeffer, or Bonhoeffer's own role. The other thing that Chandler really notes, and this is somewhat controversial when you talk to a crowd about Bonhoeffer, is that Bonhoeffer himself in many of these different contexts was actually a minor figure. That Bacon, a biography like this, or any biography, but especially one that is this big, has a real figure and ground problem. So Bonhoeffer is the central figure in everything we're looking at, whether it's the story of the church struggle, whether it's the story of the German resistance. Now, Bacon himself was careful about this, both in the book itself and in his later talks. He was always careful to say, Bonhoeffer wasn't, the central figure in the German resistance. He wasn't the one who was going to assassinate Hitler. He wasn't at the head of the church struggle. And yet, I think because of the storyline itself, perhaps because of our desire to find heroes in this bleak era, and because of some other books that have been written, Bonhoeffer kind of gets put there. So that in the films, for example, Bonhoeffer is, meeting privately with the generals to talk about, killing Hitler, or he's actually, actively saving Jews, or he's kind of, the guy at the head of everything, whereas in real life, he really wasn't. And so we kind of lose sight of where Bonhoeffer actually stood in his times. Chandler sort of ends this review by saying that he also notes that the Bonhoeffer story has been largely created by theologians, not historians. Bacon was a theologian. Most of the people who worked on the Bonhoeffer works were theologians. They got to Bonhoeffer through that theological interest. And so they read him theologically, and they read the history into the theology. And Chandler, as a historian, says, it's really important in this case that the theologians learn from the historians, and that as more historical work gets done, we might actually come to understand Bonhoeffer differently. And, you know, if I've made one minor contribution to the Bonhoeffer works, I think it was the fact that I was general editor for the historical volumes, which were the last volumes in the series, and really wanted to make sure that we had, you know, accurate footnotes, that I was able to bring in other research that maybe the German editors hadn't been aware of. And, you know, part of my role, not just in terms of the Bonhoeffer works, but at the museum itself, is really trying to broaden that field of inquiry. So if somebody comes to the museum and they're interested in looking at the history of the churches, I can help them connect the dots to the other parts of this historical era that they need to know about if they're doing this kind of research. So, you know, I've told Andrew Chandler, I think the historians also need to understand the theology, so it works both ways. And it's not that Baitke was really wrong. It's just that there were certain pieces of the puzzle he didn't have. One thing I would observe is that the biography as well as the works, in terms of the historical context that they do go into, really looks very much at the German church struggle, which is very logical. Bonhoeffer comes out of the confessing church. He plays a very active role in 1933 in the tensions with the German Christians. So, you know, that was sort of the history, the historical piece or the historical stage drop that people are familiar with, and where I would say that there has been some conversation with the Bonhoeffer legacy, because, of course, in the meantime, since Baitke wrote his biography, this biography, and it was published in Germany in the late 60s, there have been hundreds of books on the German church struggle, on other figures in the German church struggle, on the German Christians. So there have been other pieces of the puzzle that have been added that have indeed shaped our understanding of Bonhoeffer somewhat differently than when Baitke first wrote the biography. But what I'd like to do this afternoon is identify three other examples of new research. This is research that I'm doing because I'm finally writing my own Bonhoeffer book, and don't ask me why. I just say, I keep every Bonhoeffer book I see, I think, now this really needs to be the last one. But people keep coming up with, yeah, you got in under the wire, but there is new stuff to find out, and part of the research that I've been doing in the past 10 years is both on the ecumenical movement and on the international interfaith movement and church leaders in this country. And all of these figures, you know, get mentioned in the biography, but sometimes I think Baitke didn't realize who they were or what the connections were. And one of the things I want to show this afternoon is that when you get into other archives, other kinds of research, Bonhoeffer sometimes pops up in surprising places. And this gives us a new piece of the puzzle that we didn't have. So I think that the good and the bad news for those of you who want to go on and get, you know, PhDs or do some work on Bonhoeffer, is that there's still quite a bit that could be done. I mean, there really are things we don't know. I think there are questions we need to revisit. There's a really interesting new book out called Bonhoeffer the Assassin. I don't know if you've talked about it in this class. Very provocative book, and I can get into that a little bit later. But the interesting thing with that book is that I think if they had just done some other historical research, they would have been on firmer ground to make their theological arguments. So there really is a relation between understanding the historical context and understanding the role of Bonhoeffer in his theology. So the first thing I'll look at, and I just sort of slapped this together, so I'm looking in this country at the denominational landscape, leaders of different churches, Presbyterians, Lutherans, what have you. The ecumenical movement, both in the United States and in Europe, Bonhoeffer had connections in both, and the interfaith movement, in this country particularly, because one of the interesting parts of this history is that the National Conference of Christians and Jews, which was, you know, a Catholic, Protestant, Jewish organization, was founded in the late 1920s and thus became active right at the point that the Nazis were coming to power. And you know, the people who were part of that organization had ties both to the Federal Council of Churches and in some cases to European ecumenical leaders and European Jewish leaders. And so there's kind of a tapestry there of people who were doing quite significant things in the background of some of the issues that we look at in terms of Bonhoeffer. I'm going to have to walk back and forth because I have to advance the PowerPoint. So this, first of all, is a picture. These are all photographs from the United States. And I think it's important to realize what leaders, interfaith leaders, and Christian leaders in the United States were dealing with in the 1920s and 1930s in terms of a rise in hate groups, a rise in anti-Semitism, and the National Conference of Christians and Jews actually emerged or was founded in part in reaction to this. During the 1920s in this country, in the wake of World War I, you really did have a new upsurge in the Ku Klux Klan. During the 1920s, they were every bit as anti-Catholic as they were anti-black. So this was raising a lot of alarms in the Catholic churches and in more liberal Protestant communities. And so the reason, in part, for the founding of the NCCJ was to combat this kind of hatred at home. One of the things this meant was that after 1933, they looked at what was happening in Nazi Germany through a very American lens. That is, they sort of thought that the rise of Nazism in Germany was very similar to the racism in this country, to discrimination, to these kinds of things. And their approach in this country that they really, developed during the 1930s, it's an amazing organization, was that they traveled across the country. They went into communities of all kinds. Every community they went into, they reached out to Catholics, Jews, and Protestants, and they tried to form localized coalitions that would fight religious prejudice, that would fight hatred, that would find common ground on social issues, whether it was racial justice or other issues. And it was a very successful organization. They really, from the time they were founded in 1928 till the end of the 1930s, they expanded enormously. They had a huge following. They got a lot of press. The model that they were using of these localized outreach community organization in the United States was working. And that was another reason why when they looked toward Germany, they thought that they could do something there. Now, this is another historical photograph. This is actually from the museum archives. This is fascinating to me. And what I'm trying to situate right now is to give you a sense of other Christian leaders, Jewish leaders in this country, looking at what happened in 1933 in Germany and how they saw it. The Baptist World Alliance, that is representatives of all the different Baptist churches from around the world, had planned their international meeting in Berlin to hold it in Berlin in 1934 before the Nazis came to power. It was on the calendar. So when the Nazis came to power, the German Baptists, which were a small church but, relatively lively, organized the conference, were very proud of being able to host it in Berlin. As you can see from the swastika flags in the background, the German Baptists were actually very pro-Nazi. They agreed with National Socialism's, they agreed with the nationalism, they agreed with the social agenda. They thought that Hitler would be a strong leader that could bring different kinds of values back to Germany after the Weimar years. And so the German Baptists really kind of wanted to showcase what was happening in Berlin. But what happens at this meeting is that the Canadian delegates and the African-American delegates get to Berlin and are genuinely shocked by what they see and begin to sort of, push for minority resolutions to put, to talk at the meeting about what was happening in Nazi Germany. They didn't get to the top. They only were able to submit minority resolutions because most of the representatives at this meeting actually kind of pushed back. But there was a minority resolution passed at the meeting to talk about issues of nationalism and racial injustice, as they, that was the way they framed it, in Nazi Germany. And the minutes of this meeting are really interesting because you can see the discussions among Baptists from all over the world about these kinds of issues. So in other words, what was happening in Nazi Germany was sort of on the plate in terms of,
Do you know any of the names of the African-Americans?
Yes. We actually have the full minutes and the full list of all the people attending at the museum. And Beverly Mitchell, who teaches at Wesley Theological Seminary, has actually been trying to track down the African-American delegates. If you Google this, the Christian Century some years ago actually published a very nice little article about this meeting. So there hasn't been, I don't think, a dissertation published on it, but there have been some articles published about the meeting and what happened there. So let me just talk a little bit about some of these different people in the United States who play a role in what I'm looking at. One is the famous preacher of Riverside Church, Harry Emerson Fosdick. who in 1933 really became one of the leading denominational leaders in this country to decry Nazi and anti-Semitism, to push for helping refugees. He became part of an organization that was founded, co-founded by the NCCJ and the Federal Council of Churches in 1933 called the American Christian Committee, the American Committee for the Rescue of German Christian Refugees. The background of that, although it was an interfaith committee that also helped Jews and had Jewish members, was that they were afraid of not getting enough support from Christian churches if they didn't reference Christian. They were afraid if they said Jewish refugees, it would, you know, feed anti-Semitism in this country. So the committee was sort of a mixed bag from the beginning, and really struggled. And one of the interesting things and telling things about this committee is that they got far more support from Jewish organizations than they ever did from Christian churches. But the members of this committee were people like Fosdick, Reinhold Niebuhr, John Haynes Holmes, who was the Unitarian, had co-founded the NAACP, was a very strong social rights activist throughout the 1920s, and a very close friend of Rabbi Stephen Wise. And so Holmes worked very closely with Wise on these kinds of issues and was an important figure throughout this period. But some of the other interesting people that are sort of part of these larger networks I'm going to talk about are the pacifists, people who were either in the Fellowship of Reconciliation or the Quakers. And this is a really interesting story in terms of the Bonhoeffer story. Because one of the people that Bonhoeffer knew in Berlin was a man named Friedrich Sigmund Schulze. You see his picture up in the upper right-hand side. Sigmund Schulze organized sort of a social welfare ministry, working-class ministry in a working-class section of Berlin in the 1920s. Had soup kitchens, worked with people who were jobless, worked on various social justice issues. He was one of the founders of the International Fellowship of Reconciliation. He was a staunch pacifist. And I think, I was thinking today driving down, Charles, that I think the last time I was speaking to your class, I talked about Sigmund Schulze's work and noted that a lot of the women who worked with him in the 1920s subsequently ended up either helping Jews during the 1930s. Many of them went on to work in the Gruber office, which was the confessing church office that helped Jews escape Nazi Germany. And so I sort of said, I think that's really the only circle of people we see after 1933 in Nazi Germany working together with Jews. Well, I was wrong. I've done a lot more research since then, and one of the things that I've realized is the extent to which Sigmund Schulze, even before 1932 or 1933, was actively working with Jewish leaders in Berlin, Jewish leaders across Europe, and I can't remember now the order that I've got my slides in, but let me just sort of stay parked here for a minute and talk a little bit about the people portrayed here, because they really do figure some in the Bonhoeffer story. Sigmund Schulze was working before 1933 with Jewish leaders across Berlin, and as a result, he was really the point person in 1933 when the Nazis came to power, who could help connect them to Christian organizations that might be able to help them get out and help create a network to help people escape. As a result of his efforts, he was deported by the Gestapo in July of 1933. He was very quickly on the Nazis' radar. But the interesting thing with Sigmund Schulze that I've learned through looking at American archives is that he was also a point of connection for the people from the United States when they went to Nazi Germany. So the National Conference of Christians and Jews, early 1930s, they're looking at fighting prejudice at home, but they're also looking at what's happening abroad. And one of the things that they were concerned about was the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany, which was striking already by the early 1930s. So in 1932, you have an American delegation going over to Berlin to meet with German Jews, Catholics, and Protestants to talk about the issue of anti-Semitism, to talk about the rise in the Nazi Party, to sort of get it was a fact-finding trip. What's happening here? What can we report back to the States? How can we help? And their point of contact was Sigmund Schulze. The other point of contact was a man whose picture I could not find, a Jewish activist named Bernard Kahn. Kahn was an absolutely crucial person during this period, and there's so little that's been done on him. But the paper that I sent you all that's called Track 2 Diplomacy goes into the relationship between Kahn and Sigmund Schulze. Kahn was a Swedish-born doctor, became a German citizen, became active in the Jewish refugee work after the First World War, especially in reaction to the pogroms in the East, emigrated to Germany, and so he was working in Berlin in the late 1920s, early 1930s, to help Jewish refugees from the East. 1933 comes, he decides to get out of Berlin, goes to Paris, and became the European director of the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which was the primary organization in this country and internationally that tried to help Jewish refugees in Europe. So Kahn was the point of connection for diplomats. James McDonald, when he was Commissioner of Refugees, visited him. Kahn had very close connections with Sigmund Schulze. So Sigmund Schulze becomes a point in this network that's incredibly important. And in 1932, when these American church leaders go to Berlin, they meet with Kahn, they meet with Sigmund Schulze, they meet with the head of the German Zionist organization, Georg Landauer, they meet with a host of other people. They meet with Max Distel, who was the church superintendent who oversaw Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They met with Adolf Deichmann, who Bonhoeffer also knew, and they met with a man named Julius Richter, who was a mission scholar and turns out to be an incredibly important figure in this history. And again, some of these people mentioned Bethke, but Bethke didn't understand what they did or who they were. And so their significance in this story is kind of lost when you look through the Bonhoeffer lens, but when you look through this larger lens, you can kind of see it. So Sigmund Schulze, one of the women who worked in his offices in the 1920s was a German woman named Herta Kraus. Herta Kraus was a Quaker. She left Germany in 1933. She went to England. And from England, she came to this country where she headed the American Friends Service Committee, which was the primary organization during the late 1930s and especially in the war that helped Jewish refugees get to this country. The Quakers worked with everybody. They did an incredible amount. They worked all over Europe. They worked in North Africa. And we have the American Friends Service Committee archival records at the museum in Washington. So I've actually gone through them. And it's absolutely fascinating because they've got the personal files on every refugee they helped. And some of these files really kind of tell the life story. One of the refugees they helped was a man named Herbert Jähle. Jähle was a friend of Bonhoeffer. Jähle was a pacifist, and Jähle was actually the friend that Bonhoeffer was thinking of traveling to India with to visit Gandhi. Jähle was a physicist. He actually met Bonhoeffer through Bonhoeffer's brother because Jähle and Carl Friedrich studied physics together. He got acquainted with Bonhoeffer, got involved in the Confessing Church, and so Bonhoeffer and Jähle were friends. From 33, 34, 35, up to 36. In other words, they were close friends before Bethke met Bonhoeffer. And I think this is the other part of the story to remember, is that Bethke met Bonhoeffer at a certain point and didn't always know what had gone before. So Jähle and Bonhoeffer were, from Jähle's account, quite close. Jähle was involved in some of the illegal Confessing Church activity, including the sending of the memorandum to Adolf Hitler in 1936. In Jähle's testimony to the Quakers, he says that he left Nazi Germany because he was afraid of endangering Bonhoeffer, because Jähle was a Quaker, he was a conscientious objector, he was afraid that his activities would draw attention to Bonhoeffer. Now, when historians read these things, you're reading his version, you don't quite know if this is accurate, but this is what he said. So Jähle, went to England to study, he came back, and then he got a position in Brussels, and he was in Belgium when the Germans invaded Belgium. When the Germans invaded Belgium, the Gestapo, looked up all the Germans who were in Belgium. They noticed that he was a conscientious objector. They interrogated him. They made him an offer. This is fascinating. This is from a letter that Jähle writes to Sigmund Schulze, because Jähle and Sigmund Schulze were quite close. They made him an offer because he was a brilliant physicist, and they said, look, you can work on the bomb. We'll keep you out of trouble. We'll make you a deal. Jähle turns him down, and as a result, Jähle is sent to the concentration camp in Gurs in the south of France. Gurs was a camp that held various kinds of prisoners, some of them people like Jähle. Some of them were German Jews who were sent to Gurs before they were deported. Some of them were French Jews who were sent to Gurs. So there's a lot of different traffic going in and out of Gurs during this period. But Yale's in Gurs, and Jähle, because of his Quaker connections, starts talking to the Quakers who visit the camps. The Quakers, as I mentioned, were really active in Europe. They really tried, and especially in places like France, they could get into camps. And Yale's story is that the CEMAD, which was the French resistance organization, when they visited the camp of Gores, he spotted somebody in CEMAD that he knew, and he said, Madeline. And Madeline looked over and said, Herbert, what are you doing here? Anyway, so that activated her to help get Yale to the United States. Yale's visa application was supported by several people, including Albert Einstein. You know, he was a brilliant physicist. So Yale gets to this country in 1941, really struggles. This is, you know, part of one of the things you realize when you look through these refugee records is how hard it was for refugees when they got here to get a job, to find their footing, to find a place. And that's why the Quaker files are so fascinating, because they've got all the attempts to try to settle people. So Yale gets to this country, eventually finds a place, finds a teaching job. After the war, gets back in touch with Eberhard Baecke, meets Maria von Wedemeyer when she comes to this country, actually was apparently romantically interested in her for a short time. So Yale was somebody who somehow really did stay in the Bonhoeffer story loop, because this friendship with Bonhoeffer had been really important to him. And one of the things that he says both in the Quaker records when he applies to come to this country and in his citizenship application to this country is that the person who taught him everything he knew about pacifism was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So it's a very striking statement by somebody, not Baecke, about where Bonhoeffer was coming from, at least in the early 1930s. And the interesting thing with Baecke is that, or with Yale, is that Yale thought that Baecke got Bonhoeffer wrong in some points. So when Yale read the biography, he actually wrote Baecke, tried to get him to change some things. Sort of an interesting outside lens at looking at the story that we have, not necessarily dismantling it. You need a lot more historical research to do that, but really showing that this was an experience and a set of connections, both in terms of Yale and Sigmund Schulze, that Bonhoeffer wasn't aware of. The other person here, John Nevin Sayre, was the head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation in this country during the war and after the war. And Sayre was really interested. He had connections to both Yale and Sigmund Schulze. And Sayre was really interested in the Bonhoeffer story. And so there's this whole body of literature that comes out of these pacifist circles that gives us some insight both into how they understood him, and in the case of Sigmund Schulze and Yale, what kinds of different connections they actually had to him. So let's look at some of the other people in the network that, again, pop up in Baecke, but not necessarily in a way where he recognized them. Now, some of these names, I don't know if any are familiar to you, but this was a sign of the ecumenical Jewish cooperation. And again, one of the things I've really been looking at is cooperation between Christians and Jews during this period, because for a long time, Holocaust scholars have assumed that there really wasn't that much connection. And what I've been discovering in my research is that there was actually quite a bit of communication, and some of it at the highest ecumenical level. Adolf Freudenberg was a member of the Confessing Church, left Nazi Germany because his wife was Jewish, initially went to England, then ended up in Geneva helping refugees. He worked very closely with Gerhard Regner, who was the head of the World Jewish Congress in Geneva. And Regner, Wissert Hooft, who was the other ecumenical leader in Geneva, Freudenberg, Regner, and Wissert Hooft met weekly during the war to get news out about what was happening to the Jews of Europe. They were also the place where a lot of information came in. So this was really a hub of information. And one of the things that I've looked at when I've looked at some of these other people are the connections or the meetings between people like Freudenberg and Wissert Hooft and Bernard Kahn, George Bell. There are these people in Bonhoeffer's network that knew each other, that met together specifically on the issue of refugees. And I just mentioned George Bell because, of course, he plays a large role in the Bonhoeffer story. Bell, Bishop of Chichester, is somebody who really mentored Dietrich Bonhoeffer during his years in London, stayed in touch with him, was his primary point of ecumenical contact once Bonhoeffer entered the resistance. And so that's the story of Bell that we get in the Bonhoeffer works and in the Baecke biography. But Bell met regularly with people like Bernard Kahn, with James McDonald, with these other networks who were coming to Europe to try to find out what was happening, and above all, trying to help Jews get out of Europe. Bell also had close connections to the Quakers because his sister-in-law, a woman named Laura Livingston, was a Quaker and actually worked in Berlin throughout the 1930s. So Bell is an interesting figure because he's got connections to all these different groups. And one of the fascinating things in the archival research I've been doing is coming across documents that give an account of a meeting between Bernard Kahn, James McDonald, George Bell, and a young German in London. And, Bonhoeffer is never named by name, but there are several meetings during the time that Bonhoeffer is in London of this nature where there's a young German. And, yeah.
Why would that be?
I think simply not to let that person remain nameless. And so, we don't know that the young German is Bonhoeffer. And yet the date, tracing all this and dating it suggests that it may well be. And in a minute, I'll get to a piece of evidence where Bonhoeffer is mentioned by name. So these are all different networks that Bonhoeffer sort of has a connection to, but they're doing other things than what Baker talks about in the biography, and that's one of the things that I think opens up new avenues of inquiry. Now, here's a picture at the lower right of the National Conference of Christians and Jews. The people shown there, the man on the left is J. Elliot Ross, who was a Catholic priest, Everett Clinchy, who was the Protestant founder of the NCCJ, and a rabbi named Morris Lazarin, who was their Jewish staff member. They helped found the British Council of Christians and Jews in 1942. And the Anglican Church had a huge role in the interfaith movement in Great Britain, particularly the Archbishops of Canterbury, Cosmo Long, and subsequently William Temple. So let me talk about some of the U.S. religious leaders actively involved in responses to Nazism at this point. A few names you might recognize and several that you probably don't. There are three Jewish leaders here, Jacob Marcus, Morris Lazarin, whom I mentioned, and a rabbi named Jonah B. Wise. And Jonah Wise is an interesting figure, partly because I think he's actually the Rabbi Wise that Bonhoeffer was in touch with, not Stephen Wise. There's one reference in the works to Stephen Wise during Bonhoeffer's time in America. There's a mention in one of the documents that he went to hear Rabbi Wise preach. And then in the biography in 1933, there's a mention that in the spring of 1933, Bonhoeffer wants to send a report about what's happening to Jews in Berlin to Rabbi Wise. And so our assumption has always been Stephen Wise, because that's the big name, that's who we know. But Jonah Wise is the more likely candidate because he was actually one of the leading rabbis in New York City during Bonhoeffer's time there. He was the rabbi of the Central Synagogue on Central Park West, a very large synagogue, and very renowned as a speaker. So that people, really did visit the synagogue to hear him speak. Most importantly, Jonah Wise had connections to all the people I've just been talking about. He was on the American Committee for the Help of Christian Jewish Refugees. He had connections to the NCCJ. He worked very closely with people like Reinhold Niebuhr, Henry Lieber from the Federal Council of Churches, and he went to Berlin in the spring of 1933. So Jonah Wise in 1933, once things are happening in Nazi Germany, gets leave from his congregation to, volunteer his services for the American Joint Distribution Committee. So Jonah Wise at that point becomes a very strong player in these interfaith circles. Jacob Marcus is an interesting figure, also a rabbi from Cincinnati. The interesting thing with Jacob Marcus is that he's one of several Jewish leaders who visit Germany during the 1930s, both to see what's happening and to see if they can help refugees. The other person that I'm going to talk about now is Morris Lazarin, who worked for the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Morris Lazarin was a Baltimore rabbi, became very active in the interfaith movement in the early 1930s. And as you know, I mentioned before, that the interpretation that the NCCJ gave on what was happening in Nazi Germany as it unfolded was through an American lens. They really sort of saw this as the kind of prejudice we had in this country, and a prejudice that could be addressed perhaps by bringing people together, by educating them about each other, by getting people in conversation. And so the NCCJ has this idea in 1935 that they're going to go over to Berlin, they're going to go to Nazi Germany, and they're going to bring Jews and Nazis and other people together to talk about their differences. And Lazarin gets a leave of absence from his congregation in Baltimore to go to Berlin, and he actually thinks that he might move there if things go well. You know, when you read his correspondence, it's a really amazing story. He met with Ambassador Dodd, you know, he met with lots of people, met with Jonah Wise, sort of made all the connections. All of his correspondence went through Bernard Kahn's office, so there are reports back to Kahn. You know, Lazarin sort of was in touch, had all these feelers out to everybody, goes to Berlin in 1933, arrives there in February, thinking that he's going to be working for Interfaith Understanding, and within 5 days, he's in an absolute state of shock. And, you know, his letters are just, he's absolutely stunned. You know, he says, I had no idea it was like this. It's so bad. You know, there's nothing we can do here. The only thing we can do is try to help people. And so at that point, Lazarin decides in Berlin that he's going to try to help whoever needs a visa. He's going to do his best to help them. And that's what he spent his remaining time in Berlin doing. He stayed in Berlin until May of 1935, then came back to this country and gave a lot of talks where, among other things, he talked a lot about his meetings with people who were, had been in the Confessing Church. And the interesting thing for Lazarin, and this again shows the importance of somebody like Julius Richter, is his point of contact in Berlin was Julius Richter. Sigmund Schulze was gone. I mean, he had been deported. And so, you know, Americans going to Berlin sort of said, you know, who can I trust? Who can put me in touch with people? Julius Richter was still there. And so Julius Richter becomes Lazarin's point of contact to the Confessing Church and, as we can see, to the Bonhoeffer family. So this is the first letter I found in Lazarin's papers, and I'll show you the handwriting. I don't know if you can notice it. But this is a letter from a woman named Martha Kramer, who's the wife of Walter Kramer, who was Karl Bonhoeffer's assistant at the Charity Hospital. Kramer was of Jewish descent. He was affected by the Aryan laws. He lost his job, and so he was trying to get a visa. And somehow, Lazarin gets invited to the Bonhoeffer home, where he meets the Kramers. And this is Mrs. Kramer's follow-up letter to him. Dear Mr. Lazarin, I hope you're well. I don't know if you remember. You can see I met you at the Bonhoeffer house. You can see where she writes Bonhoeffer there. And so Lazarin agrees to try to help the Kramers get out, and begins to send, you know, correspondence to his contacts, including people in this country, to help the Kramers get a visa. And in a way, this story really does give you a sense of what I was talking about earlier, the difficulties of getting visas. So this is a letter back from Lazarin. I don't know if you can, yeah, I guess it comes up well. You know, he writes back and says, I've thought often of your husband. I've got back. As soon as I got back, I started getting in touch with people. I want you and your husband to keep in touch with me. I'll do my best, you know, to do that. You can see the difficulty he had. This is a very typical letter, not just in the joint distribution files, but in the Quaker files. You know, if you look at, I'm looking at the phrase in here? But, you know, this is a letter sort of talking about, you know, the Kramer's qualifications. And you can see the mention of I think Bonhoeffer is actually mentioned in this letter. I don't have my glasses on. But, you know, talking about the important work that Kramer's doing. This is a letter that is the one I was talking about that is so typical, where it says, you know, I just had a letter from professor saying he has on his list 90 PhDs out of work. And this was the reality of everybody trying to get a visa to this country, was that they were all overqualified and there was no work for them. This is the one that mentions that Bonhoeffer, you know, has brought it to his, Professor Bonhoeffer has brought it to his attention. The other interesting thing in the Lazarin files, and I don't have a copy of the letter that I put in the PowerPoint, was that when Lazarin comes back to this country, you know, he comes back, continues to work, and gets a letter 1 year later from a young man named Ray Sweetman, who was working for the YMCA, was getting ready to go to Berlin, and says to Lazarin, who should I be in touch with in Berlin? And Lazarin says the younger Dr. Bonhoeffer, Richter, can put you in touch with him. So it means that Lazarin at least knew of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, certainly had had connections with the family. And you know, this is a piece of the puzzle that we simply didn't have. We didn't, you know, Baker didn't realize that there were these kinds of connections with American Jewish circles. So it's an interesting piece. We can't read too much into it. But it shows an additional connection. Now, whether Lazarin met Bonhoeffer or not is really difficult to determine. He wouldn't have met him in Berlin, because the time that Lazarin was in Berlin was when Bonhoeffer was still in London. But he, you know, Lazarin also went to London, and so there are possibilities there, but I haven't been able to find them. So these are, you know, sort of some of the examples of new puzzle pieces. The other example, and I don't want to talk too long, but what's your time frame here? I think I've gone over.
Take 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, let me just stop here for a minute. Does anyone have any questions or comments? I'm just throwing all this stuff at you, and it falls together very well in my head, but I realize that it really might not at all in yours. You know, my point in telling you all this, again, is to look at the Baitke story from outside the box and through a different lens, and see that, for example, people like Sigmund Schulze, Julius Richter, people who play minor roles in the Baitke story, were actually major figures at the time. What this does for our understanding of Bonhoeffer, I think, is a point that needs to be explored. Because just because Bonhoeffer knew somebody doesn't mean he was involved in what they were doing. But it also shows the number of people who were doing very significant and central things at the time, where all of our attention has been on Bonhoeffer, and yet there was a lot more going on that he, you know, was peripherally involved in, or perhaps not involved in at all. And yet he does seem to have been part of a network of people in Germany who were known. And the fact that Lazarin goes into the home, and, you know, it's interesting in and of itself that an American rabbi is in the Bonhoeffer home in 1935, when Dietrich is already under some Gestapo scrutiny. It's not an unrisky thing to do. Lazarin, before he went to Berlin, had spoken to Bernard Kahn and said, you know, what do I need to know? And Kahn said, as long as you don't visit the Jewish organizations, you're okay. He said, you can visit individuals. And so you've got this network of Jewish leaders in 1935, 1936, who are still going to Berlin and going to individual people's homes to have conversations with them and, of course, report back. But they still need to be careful. And Lazarin, when he came back to this country and spoke about his time in Berlin, you know, it's very interesting because especially when he talks about several meetings with people in the Confessing Church, it was clear that they were scared to death. You know, and he doesn't mention their names. He kind of disguises the circumstances. When he speaks about them, he's incredibly cautious, even speaking in this country, about what he had seen in Berlin. But I think it shows the level of surveillance that was in place and the level of fear and nervousness, and that's one reason why it's all the more striking that you've got these people doing things. Yeah?
These Americans that they opportunity to go to Germany uncover facts, as you might say.
Yeah.
Who were they reporting back to?
Their respective organizations. So the Federal Council of Churches people came back and reported both back to the FCC and in some cases to the denominations. The FCC was politically, you know, high profile and very active, so they actually helped organize rallies. You know, they would come back and give press, they would make statements to the press about what they had found. The NCCJ likewise, the NCCJ was very high profile, but the NCCJ also then sent reports to the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. There was sort of there was also a level of communication where they were just letting people know what was going on and how things were going. And the joint was, the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee was incredibly active during this period. In fact, they're really kind of the heroes of that era. And you know, their relationship with the Christian community was a very ambivalent one, because there were simply not that many Christians who were that serious about the specific issue of the persecution of the Jews. And so a couple of the people at the NCCJ and at the Federal Council of Churches were the main point people for that. But, you know, again, you look at somebody like Sigmund Schulze, you know, in Geneva. I mean, there was this network, and this becomes especially interesting during the war when, you know, the actual genocide begins, war is going on, and it's much, much harder for Jews to get out. I have a colleague at the museum in Washington who's doing her dissertation on the War Refugee Board, which was formed in, I think, late 1943. And one of the things she's discovered in the records of the War Refugee Board is that when they begin to send money over to Europe to help Jews get visas, and they actually did manage to rescue several hundred thousand Jews, that money went through the ecumenical offices in Geneva, through Freudenberg's office. Freudenberg becomes a big player during the war in terms of what he's doing. And the fact that, you know, they had both the connections and they had the means to, you know, get money through to help Jews get out. So the connections, sort of the working relationships, go all the way through. The NCCJ had a little newsletter, and they would sort of, you know, have little reports, but they're not as detailed as the reports you find in the archives, in which they really go into a lot of detail on what they're finding, and of course the correspondence between people is where you really find that. Yeah.
So the Jews who are getting out at this time, you mentioned the one like with the PhD, are they just mostly socially well connected Jews? Is there
Yeah, it's a great question. Ultimately, the Quakers helped everybody. So when you look through the Quaker records, you really do get a very wide spectrum of people. Now, the people I've been looking at, I've actually just sort of been doing searches in the Quaker records for the names I know. And I kind of actually started with some Bonhoeffer-related names, but then names from the Confessing Church. They had more connections than other people. They also had more connections abroad. But the Quakers really worked on all levels to try to get people out. Yeah.
Are these copies of the Quaker records, or are these the old?
These are the records.
Records themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any direct connection between the AFSC as an organization and Bonhoeffer?
No. There really isn't. And this is one of the things, in fact, I mentioned that the new book on pacifism, and maybe this is a good time to talk a little about this issue of pacifism, because, you know, Bonhoeffer knew individuals. He had known Sigmund Schulze, he knew Jela, and I would say Jela is perhaps the closest connection in terms of somebody who's a link to these pacifist organizations. But in Berlin itself, he does not seem to have been connected to the Quaker community in Berlin, and there was a very active one. And, you know, his interest in visiting Gandhi and sort of pursuing nonviolence, when you look at those documents and you look at the trajectory of that, it really is kind of his own interest. I mean, he brings Jela in, they go talk to people in London about it, you know, they talk to other people in England, but it's not connected to the Quakers as an organization. And this was actually one of the things that comes out in the late 1940s in some of the Fellow of Reconciliation records and the Quaker records, where people sort of say, well, you know, Bonhoeffer, he wasn't one of us. You know, I mean, they respect him, but they don't, you know, he's not coming from that place. And that's one reason why I think this new book, Bonhoeffer the Assassin, I think theologically it's interesting, and some of the readings of Bonhoeffer's texts are really, you know, they're valuable. I mean, this is one of the exciting things, is when you get people from other traditions reading the Bonhoeffer texts and finding things in them. But historically, the book doesn't hold up because they didn't look at this stuff. Basically, they just, you know, the argument they make in the book is kind of that, you know, Bonhoeffer was a pacifist. We can see this from his theological work, and therefore Bacon must have been wrong, that he was in the resistance. And, you know, that's not history. I mean, that's, you know, sort of, you've got to have more there. And it was frustrating for me to read that book for that reason, because I thought, oh, guys, you know, there's more stuff you could have done here because of Jela. And Jela is such an interesting figure, because Jela is the one after the war who said, you know, he was a pacifist. The Bonhoeffer I knew was a pacifist. And, you know, it gets up there. Yeah. Yeah, I actually interviewed his wife, or his widow, about 10 years ago. So,
well,
Yeah, no, we, Clifford Green and I actually went down to interview her to see, you know, what she knew, and you know, I've got the notes of that interview with her. And she was the one who told me that, that Yale had disagreed with some aspects of Bonhoeffer's, or aspects of the way that Bake portrayed Bonhoeffer. Looking at his post-war records is very moving. I mean, he named his two sons Dietrich and Eberhard for these two individuals. And really, you know, when he went to Germany, he visited Bake. I mean, he really nurtured that connection. And so obviously, really, there was a connection there. And, you know, the other thing is that there are some records of his up at the Swarthmore Peace Archives in terms of his correspondence with Sigmund Schultz and other people who were in the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
The students might like to hear the anecdote. In the 70s, there's Tuesday Evening Concert Series, and he's a physicist who's doing his physics, and the rest of us were enjoying the music.
Yeah.
He was in a different place.
Yeah,
so many vast memories.
I think, you know, it's funny. I mean, Chandler, in his essay, The Quest for the Historical Bonhoeffer, notes the fact that when you get other historical work about some of these people, you know, their profile in the Bonhoeffer story rises or falls. And I think Yale is a person whose profile rises. I think there was more of a relationship there than Bake knew or talked about. Hildebrand, Franz Hildebrand, on the other hand, really doesn't seem to have been have had much significance. I mean, that I think Baker read a lot more into that relationship than was actually there, and that's based on the biography of Hildebrand that was published by Holger Rogeland for a few years ago, as well as just looking through the documents and the works. You know, Baker pulled certain things out and, you know, emphasized them, and yet, you know, when you look at them through other historical documentation, you know, it seems like the emphasis is off, is not correct, you know. Yeah.
Excuse me, with that ecumenicalism, and you mentioned that Bonhoeffer is attracted to so many different Christian groups. Do you know why, either historically or theologically, why he's so appealing to so many?
Well,
I know this won't be a short answer, but it's simple.
You know, I've been thinking about this spring, actually. You know, I go through different stages of thinking about the phrase religionless Christianity, as do most Bonhoeffer scholars. I'd be interested to hear where you are right now with that. But where I am right now with it is that I think actually he kind of pulled that off in a sense, that he managed to write theologically about Christianity in a very essential way that speaks to Christians across the board. Not just in terms of, you know, the theological spectrum, but internationally, when you look at Bonhoeffer's following internationally. So it's not tied into a certain understanding of Lutheranism or Catholicism or Presbyterianism or what have you, but he really just kind of manages again and again to boil everything down to the essence. And that was, I think that was what he was after. And certainly that was what he really... Perhaps. Well, I mean, yeah. No, I mean, I think it goes way back. I mean, you can kind of trace this element of this thought way back, and you certainly find it then up through the prison letters, where, you know, he's just saying, you know, what does Christianity mean? And so I think that's part of it anyway, because he does seem to write about Christianity in a language that people gravitate to. You know, if you just think about the book Discipleship, yeah. Oh, I think we can analyze his relationship with everybody. and I think Bart, you know, Bart was a conversation partner for him. I mean, Bonhoeffer was a dialectical thinking, so he liked to engage with people. You know, he was challenged by Bart, and he challenged Bart in turn. So I think that all these people are, he really liked people who helped him think, you know.
I was just interested because you were saying most people who focused on him have been theologians.
Yeah, right.
Naturally, an interlocutor of interest would be Bart.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, what I'm trying to do is sort of get outside that theological conversation, say, so who was Bonhoeffer if you really look at him in this broader theological or broader historical context? The other person I'll throw in there, or do we need a break?
There's a there's so many questions I feel percolating in the room, including my own. Why don't we take a 5-minute, 6-minute break to refill our coffee cups? I know, of course, we can open up the board to anything. But looking at Bonhoeffer studies, the history of Bonhoeffer studies, can you sort of give us a map of the earlier eras, how you would describe these earlier eras of Bonhoeffer studies and what, you know, what this new era promises?
Well, let's see.
How would you characterize the first generation?
Well, yeah, I think it does begin with the people who study with him at Finkenwalde after the war. It begins with the early publication by Baker of the prison letters in the 1950s. I mean, there's certain things that happen in the 1950s that where Baker himself, I think, was really surprised by the broad reaction, the interest. Baker came to this country in the late 1950s to speak about Bonhoeffer at Harvard and also to begin work on the biography. And one of his comments during that visit was that already everybody had his own Bonhoeffer, that people sort of had grabbed onto the story. And, sort of we're already kind of interpreting it. So the interpretation sets in immediately. And I think some of that also dovetails with the early hagiography about the German church struggle. Niemöller had been released from Dachau. There were certain names out there in the late 1940s, early 1950s that people kind of latched onto. So the early picture of Bonhoeffer is this person sort of at the head of the anti-Nazi opposition, member of the Confessing Church. The Confessing Church at that point was really understood very hagiographically as a very, courageous movement against National Socialism. So, in a way, that's sort of all of a piece in the 50s and 60s. And then in the late 1960s, you begin to have the first inklings of more critical scholarship on the Confessing Church, which really looked much more at the historical record, was written not by people who'd been part of it, but by the next generation, really looked at the anti-Semitism, which was very prevalent in the Confessing Church, looked at all the compromises. Niemöller himself, he was still alive, he was being interviewed, but interviewed more critically. And the interesting thing there is I think you can sort of see how Bonhoeffer is kind of excluded from that critical study. And in a way, I think that's been one of the problems with the Bonhoeffer opus, if you will, is that the way the story, proceeded really was on a separate track from the more critical historical work that was done on the Confessing Church and some of its leaders and the Germans as a whole. If you fast forward till today, where you really have a lot of work in Holocaust studies about Nazi Germany that looks very critically, especially at the abundant evidence of complicity. Bonhoeffer is still kind of held outside of that sphere, and I think it's inevitable that's going to change. Now, that change, I already skipped several decades there, that began to change in the 1970s with the rise of Holocaust studies in this country. And the interesting thing there is that Baker was part of that. Eberhard Baker traveled to this country a lot, and during the 1970s, the Minister Franklin Littell, with several other colleagues, founded something called the Annual Conference on the Holocaust and the Churches. And Littell's goal was to get churches really aware of the role of churches in National Socialism, in anti-Semitism, to really look at this history more critically. And at its peak, it was a huge conference. Hundreds of people attended it. It was really the first Holocaust Studies conference, so it dovetailed with the early generations who were entering the field. And Baker became very involved in it. This was something Baker himself was very interested in. He was interested in Jewish-Christian dialogue back in Germany. He was instrumental in getting the German church to sort of look at the issue of anti-Semitism in the churches. So, Baker came to this country and I think was somewhat shocked by the very critical Jewish attitude toward Bonhoeffer. My friend Susanna Heschel has described to me how her father, when the biography came out, her father bought the biography. He wanted to read it, read the biography all the way through, threw it down on the table, said, he didn't do anything. I mean, that was the Jewish attitude. They looked and they said, what were they talking about? What did he really do? And when you look at the facts, it's absolutely true. I mean, this is where, you know, the Bonhoeffer story, you know, there's so much read back into the story. Ahistorically, we assume that he, you know, was the reason he was doing everything he was doing was to help Jews. We assume that, you know, he was here or he was there. And yet when you actually look at the evidence, he's really not in many of those places. And especially if you look at his reaction to something like Kristallnacht in November 1938, where, you know, Baker went back, moved by all these critical questions, and said, oh, you know, he wrote this in the margin of his Bible. Well, okay, you know. Really, I mean, you know, what does that mean? Kristallnacht in Germany was actually a moment where you did have a couple of people step up to the plate in the confessing church and stick their necks out and preach sermons. You know, there's a preacher named Julius von Jahn in Württemberg who preached such a sermon that he was beat up by thugs. You know, his farmhouse was vandalized. He was arrested and sent to a camp for a little bit. I mean, there were people who really did speak out and suffered the consequences. And, you know, one of the things that has struck me in going through the works is the number of compromises he made, the number of times where he seemed to duck, the indecisiveness. You know, I think that there's an aspect of Bonhoeffer that, you know, we need to recognize when you really look at him up close, and based on that basis, really think about who he was. I mean, I think that there's a possibility for rethinking Bonhoeffer, but only if we've got the critical capacity to kind of step away from the biography. And Baker, because he was so engaged in these conversations, and Baker was a remarkable person. He was not defensive, and he would take these questions and he would say, wow, I really need to think about this, and I'll go back and look at this, I'll think about it. So, you know, Baker's essays about Bonhoeffer and the Jews, you know, his famous essay was Bonhoeffer, One of the Silent Bystanders. You know, he really went back and struggled with things. You know, and in that way, you know, some of what we're reading into Bonhoeffer is, in fact, I would say, Baker. Yeah.
Would you think that Bonhoeffer's romanticized kind of like
a hero I think definitely so. I mean, there's definitely a mythology there. And, you know, the interesting thing is that Baker on a number of occasions tried to stop that. I mean, when you heard him talk or in his essays, you know, he makes a point of saying, now, don't read too much into this. Or, you know, I want to be clear, you know, he wasn't this, he wasn't that. And yet, that's kind of where we've put him. And so it gets really hard, you know, when you talk to groups about Bonhoeffer who think, you know, we all know Bonhoeffer, right? And you say, well, you know, actually, he wasn't there. He wasn't, you know, it's hard, you know, for people then to place him. Then they say, well, who was he? And, you know, I don't think it's possible at this point to go back to the very beginning. And like I said, Baker got an awful lot right, and we do have all these documents there. But that's why I think at this stage in time, it's helpful to look at this bigger historical picture. And really try to think about, you know, where we see Bonhoeffer in there and where he's not, you know, where he's not present.
Other questions?
I was going to throw one more example in, and this might be a good one in terms of your question, because I think the other thing about you know, the Baker's reconstruction of the Bonhoeffer story is that he was very sensitive to the family in the wake of what had happened in 1945. And for that reason, there were certain things he didn't touch. There's a biography that appeared in Germany a couple years ago of Paul von Hase, who was the cousin of Bonhoeffer's mother, so Bonhoeffer's second cousin. And the role that Paul von Hase plays in the Bonhoeffer opus is that he's the city commander of Berlin during the war. And so when Bonhoeffer's arrested, the family turns to him and says, can you help? And Paul von Hase visits Tegel prison, where Bonhoeffer's being held, and all the prison guards, you know, sort of, oh, you know, he's related to him. And so after that, you know, Bonhoeffer gets much better treatment, he gets special privileges. Bonhoeffer's very embarrassed about this, but, you know, there's no more than that. Well, this biography of Paul von Hase really kind of shocked me, because Paul von, you look at this guy's, you know, career path through the Nazi years. He was a career military officer. So 1933, like most career military officers, he welcomed the rise of National Socialism. He thought Hitler was a great leader, begins to follow his career, moves up very rapidly. By 1937, he's been able to move into a villa that has been taken from a Jewish family. After Kristallnacht, he gives a speech blaming Jewish rabble-rousers for undermining the folk. You know, he gives one speech after another, which is very pro-Nazi. Their youngest child is born in 1938, and the mother begins to keep a diary for the little boy and begins to talk about, you know, the glorious days of the Reich and how Hitler's doing all these things. So, you know, the family, in terms of what they're saying publicly and privately, really is in line with what's happening. He leads one of the divisions in the invasion of Poland. He then leads his division into the invasion of France, becomes city commander of Paris under German occupation, and then is promoted back as city commander of Berlin. And when he gets that post, no one less than Joseph Goebbels says, "Great choice, this is a man we can work with." So, you know, Paul von Hase is, you know, in it. And 1944 comes along. 5 days before the coup attempt, the conspiracy goes to Paul von Hase and says, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to try to overthrow the regime. We're going to kill the leading Nazis. We need you to seal off the government buildings in the city so that we don't get any sort of Nazi groups trying to stop us." And Paul von Hase agrees. So he's informed, you know, July 20th comes, the coup begins, he gets the word that they've started, he seals off the city, and with that, his fate is sealed. July 21st, he's arrested. Initially, the leading Nazis can't believe that, you know, he was really involved, and he manages to kind of fool them. So for the first week, he's treated as a very privileged prisoner. Then they, you know, make enough of the connections that the gloves come off, and he's executed in early August. Hitler was absolutely furious at all of the leading people that had tried to overthrow him, and so he went after the families. He arrested Paul von Hase's wife and their children. The youngest son, the one who was the little boy born in 1938, was actually taken under an assumed name to an orphanage, where presumably he could be adopted out to a good Nazi family. The wife and their oldest daughter is imprisoned in the woman's prison in Berlin. Their oldest son, who's 19 years old, is imprisoned and tortured so badly he had lifelong neurological damage. And so when Margarete von Hase gets out of prison in early September of 1944, having had all this happen, and she has nowhere to go because their home has actually been confiscated by Heinrich Himmler, who moves into their home because his home has been bombed out. So she comes out of prison. She has literally only the shirt on her back. And she goes to the one place in Berlin where she thinks they're going to take her in. It's the Bonhoeffer family home. She goes to the home of Renate Schleicher, or Ursula Schleicher, Bonhoeffer's sister, which is right next door to the Bonhoeffer family home. At that point, Ursula Schleicher's husband and Klaus Bonhoeffer had not yet been arrested. And so Schleicher welcomes her, takes her in. Klaus Bonhoeffer comes over to talk to her about what's happened, to, you know, hear what she has to say. Within a week, the Gestapo has come and arrested both of them. And she blamed herself to the end of her life because she felt that she had led the Gestapo to them. So, you know, this is something Bacon never talked about. You know, he never talked about the other people in the conspiracy, people like Canaris, who was, you know, a drinking buddy of Reinhard Heydrich. I mean, you know, these people are Nazis. And even if they had enough conscience that they tried to overthrow the regime, they still had bloody hands. And, you know, this is an aspect that I think Baker just felt he couldn't touch. And so it kind of gets passed over, and yet, I think that it should lead us to read Bonhoeffer's prison writings entirely differently. I certainly do. I published something about 10 years ago about his role in the resistance, and this aspect of it, the fact that he was, you know, working, he had kind of thrown his lot in with this very mixed group of people. You know, if you want heroic figures from the Nazi era, this is not really where you look. And, you know, his writings about guilt during that period, you know, his famous essay, After 10 Years, I think all of these really show the reflections of a good man who realizes that he and his country and his family and everybody else has failed. And I think that's really how it has to be read. But you don't get that reading of Bonhoeffer if you've got sort of this heroic vision of him. And, you know, that's, and, you know, even though Baker tried to pull people away from that heroic understanding, because he didn't get into this other stuff, the stuff that historians in the meantime have gotten into, you know, he didn't have language for it. And it's something that really in the first 20 years after National Socialism, nobody wanted to touch this stuff, you know. Oh, so, yeah.
General question about the relationship between biography and theology.
Yeah.
So a lot of time, I think, with theologians, you know, we decontextualize those.
Yeah.
Writings, or the article, placed in context.
Yeah.
I think the Bonhoeffer, in some ways, is the exemplar of,
right,
of the kind of textual theologian in the context. And I think,
yeah,
that a lot. So obviously, biography and theology are actually mutually influenced.
Yeah.
It seems with Bonhoeffer, though, that it's almost the exact opposite, that it's heavily related towards. I wonder if you think that we do that too much.
Yeah.
Is the kind of balance there, you know, related to heterogeneity?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think the balance is off. And, you know, I sort of obviously tilt toward getting as much history in as we can. But I do think, in one sense, a lot of the theological stuff is just theology. That's one of the things that really struck me in working on volume 14 of the Bonhoeffer works. And, you know, if you're interested in Bonhoeffer's theology, and especially the Finkenwalde period, it's a great volume because there's a lot in there that I think is kind of straight theology. You know, he really was trying to train these young pastors in waiting for the ministry in Nazi Germany. And I, you know, at that point, for all he knew, this was going to go on for 1,000 years. So he was training them in a way that he thought they could hold their own in this ideologically charged environment. And really kind of doing it by going back to, you know, a deeply grounded theological understanding. So, you know, you kind of have to have both sets of eyes working. But you're right, you can't overemphasize one. You can't sort of take some of these texts and say, well, you know, this was on the day when, you know, Hitler marched into the Rhineland. Because that may or may not be relevant. It may be that on that day Bonhoeffer's really, you know, thinking theologically. Another question, or did you have another question?
You're obviously into all of the correspondence of the time. Do you read, or did you pick up on a frustration? Let me rephrase it.
Mm-hmm.
A reaction by these theologians, particularly those who are Christian, to kind of mobilize, galvanize a resistance for money, whatever, to help Jews, to help politically in any way whatsoever, or was it just a very directed and self-clause? Okay, this is Riverside Church, this is the Rockefeller Church.
Right, right.
For them to write a check for $100 million. Like,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They could afford the way out.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'm not hearing, mm-hmm, and what I'm looking for, mm, is some sort of real effort. I know,
yeah,
the result of it all, it's not there.
Right.
But was it at least attempted?
Yeah. I think with Fosdick, I'm not sure. I mean, he certainly was involved in meetings that I've looked at the records of the meetings. With people like Freudenberg, and Bell, and Henry Smith Leeper, I didn't even really talk about Leeper, although I showed his picture. There were a couple of church leaders in this country who really did their damnedest, who were really interested and committed and constantly pushing and enormously frustrated that they couldn't get more Christian support for what they were doing and that they couldn't really get it on the American radar. You know, this country was so isolationist in the 1930s, and they couldn't make a dent. I'm not sure what you're asking.
Bonhoeffer went back to basics. Mm-hmm. You know, through this, I'm trying to understand how he's gone back to basics, mm-hmm, and really the way in which Christianity and Judaism, they all began.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the church, from what I could learn, just was not interested.
Mm.
I'm talking about in general.
Yeah. I mean, every country kind of has its own, and every individual kind of has a certain trajectory here. If I understand your question correctly, if I just think of the church leaders in this country, whom I've looked at, one of the things that strikes me is that they were looking at what was happening in Nazi Germany as an issue of civil liberties. And this was certainly true as well of the NCCJ. Their banner, if you will, was fighting for tolerance and democracy, democratic values. Nazi Germany was showing what happens when you don't have democratic values. So they had sort of this big umbrella, as opposed to a real focus on the actual persecution of the Jews and why they were being targeted the way they were. Now you did have people in this country, I haven't really talked about them, who were already thinking in those terms, and you had James Parks in England who was already writing in these terms. The interesting thing about Parks is that he worked with James McDonald very briefly in the mid-1930s on this refugee stuff, and then just kind of left in a huff. Part of it might have been his personality, but Parks wasn't interested in that. He was interested in getting at theological anti-Semitism. So you have people wrestling with different things. But the church activists I've been looking at, and I would say the interfaith activists, were sort of hands-on, let's help people who are being persecuted. And that was where their energy went. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another question, Matt. There are still big questions. And I can gather where you're headed a little bit. I understand this tension between kind of historical analysis, theological analysis, and something we're familiar with.
Theologians,
you have to do that with infinite number of figures. But what exactly do you think are, what are the big questions for you? I can put this together somewhat, but I just love to hear you really say, what are these big questions that
I really have begun to ask myself about the extent to which Bonhoeffer was really an activist or can be understood as an activist. I'm not so sure anymore about that. Part of it from looking at this, the critical period between 1935 and 1939, if what he was about was something different. I haven't decided, and I go back and forth, but that's one of the things that I kind of, when I look through these writings, the other thing that this is something I've noted. I wouldn't say it's a question, but I think it's something that really needs to be dealt with, is I think his thinking about church-state issues is overlooked in terms of understanding his theology. I actually think that, his opposition to Nazism started with his politics, not with his theology. And that, tracing his political thinking and the way it shapes the church-state stuff is an interesting thing to pursue. I mean, it's one of the things I'm kind of writing about right now. So I've been thinking about that a lot lately. But yeah.
So someone has a broad scope of scholarship over the years, thinking about a new era of scholarship, have three questions. What are early Bonhoeffer stuff, late Bonhoeffer, between different eras, different portions of his writings? You think what areas do you think have been overemphasized? So either chronological or issues. What areas have been overemphasized? What areas have been underemphasized? Or kind of white places for scholarship? What areas do you think?
Another great question. Well, one of the things I skipped over was this whole middle decades of Bonhoeffer scholarship. And that might help address your question. I think that one of the things that happened once, Baitke kind of connected with the people in this country and in Europe who were interested in exploring Bonhoeffer, and Baitke began to systematically organize the documents and the material and begin to publish them, leading to the publication of the works, is that you sort of had this collecting of the material and, in a sense, evaluating it. This is more important. This is what this is about. This is what that's about. This is where this fits in. And you also had, I would say, sort of people coming from outside, people sort of diving into the stuff and pulling out sort of these nuggets and saying, oh, wow, look. And the let's say, the renegade interpretations of Bonhoeffer over the years, beginning with the God is Dead movement, you know, which sort of took Bonhoeffer's religionless Christianity to say, oh, well, look, you know, secularism. And Baker said, no, no, that's not what he meant. And then, you know, you get Metaxas sort of jumping in and giving his biography and saying, well, Bonhoeffer was really a fundamentalist. And, you know, people say, no, he wasn't that. And this latest book I mentioned, the Mark Nation book, where he says, well, you know, he was a pacifist and he really wasn't involved in the resistance. So, you know, some of these veer dangerously to, you know, revisionist history that simply doesn't hold up. But their attempts to sort of grab onto these nuggets, and I think that the failure of those attempts, you know, shows that we kind of have to go about it a different way. And yet, you know, what's the answer to this question? I mean, you know, we've got all this stuff, and to read through it and evaluate it, and in a sense, you know, Baker kind of did that work for us, and the German editors of the Bonhoeffer works did it for us, so that to pull certain things out now and say, you know, a lot of work went into this, but we think you're wrong, that might be what begins to happen with some of this stuff. There were a couple of documents in the works that I looked at that had been edited as though they were ahistorical. But if you know the theological arguments of the time, you realize that they're actually theological arguments with German Christians or with Karl Barth, or, you know, there's somebody that Bonhoeffer's writing at when he says this. And those are the things that I think we need to be alert to, but I haven't answered your question, have I?
It seems to me, and you know a lot more about this than I do, that the like stuff about conspiracy and the later writings, ethics and letters, are kind of more sexy documents, and there seems to be a lot of airplay.
Right.
At least to me, in the earlier stuff, or especially in Life Together and Science and stuff, seems to be sort of more themed as emotional.
Right, right.
I think, but it seems that those earlier documents are also pretty heavily voted for, at least politically formative.
Yeah. I think that's something that people are going to start pursuing if you ever get a critical mass of people who read Volume 14. It's almost as thick as this book, so it's going to be a while before we have the critical mass. But I certainly think that having gone through those documents, that I think both Discipleship and Life Together were Bonhoeffer's texts for spiritual formation of this community. What he was doing in Finkenwalde was spiritual formation, but it was spiritual formation in Nazi Germany. You know, he was training ministers whom he hoped could hold up under the pressures that they were going to be under. And so on one sense, it's very, you know, it's theology, it's Bible study, it's meditation, it's prayer. But the interesting thing is that Bonhoeffer really feels that those things have a power of their own that can withstand the forces of evil. And that, I mean, he was a very, very faithful Christian. I mean, that's one of the things I think that really sort of comes out of that for me. He really believed in what he was doing, and I think actually that's where his energies went. And I think that it was during that period that he found himself in terms of his career. You know, the early 1930s, you know, he thinks, you know, am I going to be a professor? Am I going to serve a church? Church struggle comes along. You know, there's kind of a period there where he's floating back and forth because all these things are happening and he's kind of responding to them, but he doesn't seem to have a sense of direction, and I think he really finds it in Finkenwalde. And it's very poignant when you read through that document, well, through that volume. And then the subsequent volume, after the Gestapo has closed Finkenwalde down, and he has to continue doing this underground and writing letters to people and really trying to keep their spirits up. You know, what the energy he puts into that, I think, shows that that's where his commitment really was. Yeah.
I think that Martin Luther King's love and reliance on Bonhoeffer has created a distinctively American brand of Bonhoefferism. That's a word. Mm. Like, if there's a peculiar way of understanding Bonhoeffer,
yeah,
through the lens of King and, I guess, the civil rights
struggle. Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think that the fact that you're reading Bonhoeffer, you do get that kind of inspiration for activism. And, you know, it relates to what I was just talking about in terms of the spiritual formation. It shows something that is there, that has that kind of potential, and that obviously also really inspired his students. that he put his finger on something and was able to convey it theologically, both to his students and to people later. And so that in itself is a real achievement. I mean, I think, you know, it might be 50 years from now that we decide that historically he didn't amount to much, but the theologically, that's what he gives us. So it's a matter perhaps of not turning that theological power into, you know, sort of a historical version that doesn't correspond to the truth. But I think it's definitely there. And that's certainly, I mean, I don't know, people in this room, you know, I certainly get that from Bonhoeffer through reading his stuff. And it's very powerful stuff, and I love it, you know.
So, Parker, if I don't mind, one of the aspects of this research, I understand it, is trying to construct an American Protestant reconstruct an American Protestant theological understanding of Germany in the 1930s. Mm. And, you know, obviously you'll be reading through Christian Century, Christianity in Crisis, any travel narratives that you can, Tillich went, you know, Watts and Roosevelt, mm-hmm. though you're not really talking about politics mm-hmm. so much as the attractive hostesses to the degrees at every little German town. In any case, Niebuhr goes over, where would you point for primary sources and even some, you know, secondary literature that would, you know, help shape some kind of rich kind of portrait of the American mainline Protestant perception of the emergence of Nazi and the German Christian Church?
Okay, well, the reason I was sort of clapping my hands are the letters and journals of Henry Smith Leeper. But he doesn't talk so much about Nazi Germany. Leeper went to, because he was at the Federal Council of Churches and he was the international liaison to the ecumenical movement. So he went to Europe every single year, sometimes twice a year throughout the 1930s, and wrote absolutely wonderful letters back to his family and kept notebooks. But most of his letters are not, there's some stuff in there about the German church situation. Most of them are the people he saw, the meetings he went to. I mean, they're sort of travel letters, but not a whole lot of analysis. So I think, and Leeper's letters are interesting. They're now at the Protestant or the Presbyterian Archives in Philadelphia. And I don't know if they're public yet, but I know that they've been given there. In terms of other primary material, trying to think. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of those kinds of reports, and even if you were to read through the newsletter of the Federal Council of Churches back then, the bulletin they called it. Those kind of have reports, and there is stuff in the Federal Council of Churches papers are at the Presbyterian Archives in Philadelphia. So there's quite a bit of source material there about various things, including some of these reports by people who go to Germany and report back. Now I have some of that in my dissertation, which is actually on ProQuest. I mean, you can read it. Because I was looking at the NCCJ people, but they went to Germany all the time too, and so some of their reports about what they were seeing in Germany. So there's a fair amount of firsthand stuff. The other,
I think these minutes would be fascinating.
That's what I was.
Yeah, right. They're not. We have a copy at the museum in Washington. So you can drive up there. I'll give you my card. I mean, our library and archives are open to the public weekdays, 10 to 5. So it really, you can come and use what we've got. And actually, we've got quite a bit, also in terms of published material. So we really might have some things that, and our librarians are really knowledgeable. So you might find some things there in addition to that. Just trying to think what else. I may think of more things, but.
Great, thank you. It'd be nice to see an anthology. sort of American religious
writings,
you know, sketches, reports on Nazi Germany.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that I would say every denomination has its own story. I had a fascinating letter a couple of years ago at the museum from a woman in Wisconsin who had discovered in her grandfather's papers some letters from what seemed to be a German bishop in 1939 glorifying the Nazi invasion of Poland. And so she said to me, you know, did the German churches send propaganda to this country about, you know, because that's what she thought it was. And I looked into this, and this was an interesting story in itself, but it shows the different American church takes on this. The Wisconsin Synod, which was a very conservative, small synod of the Lutheran Church, had historical relationships to Silesia, the province of Germany, so it goes back and forth in history between Poland and Germany. After World War I, Silesia was sort of no man's land. And as a result, the German church it didn't belong to the German evangelical church, and the Polish Protestant church, which was very small, didn't want it either. And so the Silesian Lutherans were without church leadership, and the Wisconsin Synod decided to step in. And so they sent missionaries from Wisconsin to Silesia in the 1920s. They founded two seminaries. They ordained people. They founded parishes. And so the letters in her grandfather's papers were from a bishop originally from someplace in southern Wisconsin who had ended up in Silesia. And finally, when Hitler marches into Poland and takes Silesia back, he says, "Thanks be to God, we're German once again." And, you know, just a fascinating story that shows the odd historical connections that people in this country from different churches made. I mean, the Missouri Synod Lutherans had connections as well to Nazi Germany that made them somewhat pro-Nazi during this period. And so every denomination, you know, the Methodists, there was a small Methodist church in Germany. There are lots of, so I think there's work to be done on the individual denominations as well that really hasn't been looked at as well. I mean, if you would go into the different denominational archives, I think you would certainly come up with some stuff.
Okay. Well, Karen and I were living in Switzerland in 1985, and she was studying art history and was beginning research on the Hungerford dissertation. And there was, we were staying at this Baptist seminary that once existed just south of Zurich on the Zurich Ruschelkamm Baptist Seminary. Mm-hmm. Baptist, now relocated to Prague.
Uh-huh.
And it was a really interesting place, international Baptist club. Mm-hmm. There's a young historian named Carol Whitman who has written, published in the past year, a history of this seminary, Experimenting Christian International Seminary. But she was writing her doctoral dissertation on German Baptist, something in the Cold War years, but had done a lot of research on German Baptists during the 30s and 40s in the context of this dissertation. Had resolved to wait out the sort of the ends of lives of the various characters in that story because it was apparently so appalling. I don't know the numbers of Baptists in Germany. It's a very interesting
It was small,
story. I mean, how many would you think?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I've seen the figure. It really wasn't more than 500,000. It was a pretty small, it was much less than that probably. It was a small church.
Do you know whether anything has been done in Germany?
There has been, I know that there's a journal article on it. I don't know more than that, but I try to sort of keep track on journal articles that have been published in journals about the different churches, and I know something's been done on the Baptist, but it seems to me it was some time ago. It was the people in the German, in the Protestant church.
People in some of these other denominations, like Baptist, whatever.
No,
the denomination was mostly pro-Nazi. Like, did they have people who kind of defected
from that? I'm not aware. I mean, that would be interesting to know. I don't think, I mean, the number of people like that was probably pretty small, and so I'm not aware of it, but it's possible, you know.
Yeah. I want to say, too, here is your chance as the writers and scholars in this room to ask the scholar, I think, has, you know, the most encyclopedic, you know, knowledge of Bonhoeffer in historical context and the resources and the manuscripts. Questions about your own research in progress. So, you know, if you have any questions about sources or ideas you want to, you know, present here.
Yep.
Yeah, quick question. So, let's say if I were writing a paper that had to deal with Bonhoeffer on freedom, where would I look for information about that outside of creation and fall?
Yeah, well, when the index volume comes out, late 2014. But the thing is, okay, so what the index volume is going to do, because I just, you know, am not going to spend the rest of my life doing the index volume, is that we put together a targeted subject index. So for freedom, for example, we direct people to volumes where that's been indexed. So then, but you can do that right now because all of our volumes are out. So you can look in every index volume for freedom and see what you come up with. And so that at least would get you started. The other thing is that there are, well, actually this is available now, the Logos digital edition of the Bonhoeffer works. Yeah. And I think that's searchable. I'm not sure. We're also, the Bonhoeffer works, both the German and the English edition, are going to be part of a collection called 20th Century Christian Theology that's being marketed by Alexander Street Press. And this is an amazing digital collection because of the search feature. And I think it's actually now being sold to libraries. So 20th Century Christian Theology.
I'll get that.
Well, see... Yeah, see if UVA Library wants to subscribe to it. I mean, this is something that, you know, you can't buy as an individual. But the nice thing with this is that we've got, as I said, we've got both the German and the English volumes in there. And then what they've done is they've got, you know, sort of this spectrum of theologians from the 20th century. So liberation theology, black theology, feminist theology, you know, some of the Germans. And so the search feature will bring things up from across the board. So if you do a search of Cheap Grace, for example, it will pick up the spot in Gutierrez where he talks about her from James Cone, or, you know, so you can actually begin to see how people have used Bonhoeffer. So it's going to be a terrific resource. And I think we're still tweaking it because I'm working with them on this, but I'm pretty sure they're already marketing it. So you might check.
We'll be reading that in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I'm looking, so race more broadly, Bonhoeffer and race, but I'm looking at comparing his American year with his trip to Italy and Africa, comparing, you know, his growth to see them in a short time.
Yeah.
But do you have anything on Bonhoeffer and race, or...
In the works themselves, you mean? Or
I guess I'm looking for more commentary on any secondary.
You know what you might do, this is sort of in keeping with my earlier remarks, is also look at the very good work that has been done on race in the Third Reich and the ways in which people thought about this, because both the Catholic and the Protestant churches, you know, had statements about this. I mean, many of them sort of viewed the Nazi laws and the Jewish question, the so-called Jewish question, as racial issues, and so they framed it that way. And that was also how people in this country framed it at the time. I mean, people put that into sort of a racialized category. And, you know, I think that that's useful when you look at Bonhoeffer to see, you know, the world in which he's living. So that, I would definitely sort of suggest doing some searches of that. The Nazi Conscience?
The Nazi Conscience.
There's a lot of good work on race in the Third Reich. You can also, I probably can't get on the internet here, but if you go to the Holocaust Museum website, and you, can we do it? I'll show you what this looks like. because our collections now are searchable online. And, you know, so you can actually see what we have, and you can see really what's available. So as soon as she, you can just close that. USHMM.org.
This is why when you say a new era of Bonner for Scholarship, I wonder whether this new era will involve, you know, correcting every, you know, naive or inaccurate interpretation of the previous era, given their lack of access to the sources and, you know, the more limited range within which they could.
Sorry, you want to go back? Sit down.
Develop, you know, a response, develop an argument.
Well, I think it's, I would warn against just nitpicking, and I have to stop myself, because it's easy to sort of go there, and yet I think what's more productive is to, you know, if you find an interpretation that just doesn't seem to fit, or, you know, to sort of engage with it, and try, you know, that's really what I try to do with this new book by Mark Nation, which has some people very upset. But I actually think it's a good faith attempt to do some different theological readings of some of our stuff. And, you know, that's why we published it, so that people would read it theologically from their different perspectives and engage. The thing is that you have to have the capacity, the critical capacity, to know where they're either, you know, sort of venturing into ground theologically where Bonhoeffer really wouldn't have gone, or historically, you know, they're not understanding his context. And so, you know, it's sort of being open to new arguments and yet, you know, developing your own area of expertise. I mean, you know, we can't know everything. So, you know, sort of carve out the area that you really want to focus on and get as expert in it as you can, and really, you know, learn it. And then you've got the skills to look at some of this other stuff, or to look at Bonhoeffer and see new things. I mean, that's what's going to lead to this new age. So this is the museum website, and if you go to our resources for academics and research, you come up with research and collections, and then you can search our collections, and you can search our library, and here's a picture of our library. And as I said, you know, it's open to the public 5 days a week. So we've got the library, we've got other kinds of collections where we've got our photo archives and documents. We have the Spielberg Film and Video Archive, photo archives, a database, a guide. We also, if you come to the museum, we have, I think, thousands, maybe over 100,000 oral histories that are searchable. So, you know, there's an awful lot here that, you know, I mean, there's still so much that could be written and researched in this field. And so, you know, if you're looking for something like race and the understanding of race in Nazi Germany, you know, you can just start looking in the library and type it in, and, you know, you'll come up with probably more books than you want. Ideology, Germany. You come up with, well, 19, so that's doable. But you know, you do different kinds of searches, and you really, you know, sort of, that's how you find stuff out. So, yeah.
Other questions or methodological research or any other questions that come to mind? Broad, free-ranging questions. We have, you know, about 8 more minutes.
So, yeah.
Hey, I am doing a... What?
No, I love this. This is great.
A research paper concerning the relationship between Bonhoeffer and Barth and the degree to which Bonhoeffer develops his own theological ideas apart from where Barth is going in church dogmatics in terms of the publication dates. What would you recommend other than, like, just reading the... where Bonhoeffer starts and Barth chronologically together and seeing how they relate? Are there any sort of scholarships done?
Yeah. There have been some good works done on this. And so I would also look for more recent journal articles. I mean, there's new stuff coming out. Mark Lindsay in Australia has written some stuff. And, you know, Charles Marsh has written.
Andreas Pongratz,
right.
I think it's been his younger, but, you know.
Yeah. Is his stuff in English?
Okay. One terrific book on Bonhoeffer and Barth that's available.
Yeah, the other thing...
I'm actually looking for, I learned it for a student a couple of years ago, and I sent out, did you get that email? I sent a few weeks ago. That book is $140 now, paperback.
Oh, dear.
Not happy about that, but that's a really helpful book.
Yeah.
Clifford Reed, who is
the other
leading volunteer scholar in the English speaking world, has written on that as well. Biographical narratives of Bonhoeffer and Barthes may be a little harder to find.
Yeah. The other thing would be, I know that some of the conference volumes of Bonhoeffer papers from various Bonhoeffer conferences, there's usually a presentation or two at these conferences on Bonhoeffer and Barthes, and to go back and look at some of those, I mean the volumes in which there are chapters like this are not immediately coming to mind. But if you just look through the books in the library of those kinds of volumes, you'll come up with them.
On another note, uh-huh. One of the things I wanted to thread into the research was the Barman Confession and sort of just the nature of how Barthes' theology is often seen as this pure, optimistic presentation of like the church and who the identity of the Christian people is, versus Bonhoeffer does seem to try to make things a little more concrete. So could you speak a little bit about Barthes' relationship to the Barman?
It's pretty much non-existent. He was in London, and he wasn't really involved. This was the stage at which he had thrown up his hands and gone to London. He was kind of out of that loop, which is interesting. Another interesting thing is that Henry Lieber, the gentleman I showed before, actually was at Barman with Bonhoeffer's cousin, Hans Christoph von Hase. So Lieber went to Barman. That is neither here nor there in terms of what you're asking. But I think that there, Barthes, in fact, some of these early theological documents that are so crucial in the theological development of the Confessing Church, which is Barman, the Bethel Confession, where Bonhoeffer, was part of those discussions, those bear looking at in and of themselves. But I think that Barthes is definitely the person to look at in terms of understanding the issues as they presented themselves at Barman, keeping in mind that Barman was really, that Barman moment had a very brief window. I mean, this was actually where they were trying to get their heads together as an entire church theologically and say, okay, so where do we stand in terms of what's happening specifically with the German Christians and with the, looming threat that the state is going to get involved in the church. And that's where I think Barthes' clarity was actually very helpful. It didn't last very long because circumstances changed so quickly and because the different regional churches and their polity, the way in which the church struggle subsequently played itself out after Barman kind of put everybody on different tracks. And that's why, 6 months later at Dahlem, they couldn't agree.
Bethel Confession, Bonhoeffer's role in Bethel, is a very important counterpoint to developing an understanding of Barthes and Bonhoeffer on Barman, because Bonhoeffer had thrown up his hands and left Germany. One of the reasons he had thrown up his hands is because of the machinations that followed the third draft of the Bethel Confession, which basically deleted section or phrasing that he had wanted to include specifically about the Arian clause. And so while Bonhoeffer affirmed the Barman statement, I don't know whether he signed it. I think he may have signed it in absentia. I'm not quite sure that he did. He was somewhat frustrated by the kind of resort to, pure theological discourse. Our pure confessional discourse as a means of communicating opposition to the Arian Clause of 1933. And so, I think that Bethel story is a dramatic.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
It also shows an impatience that Bonhoeffer had about the whole usefulness of the Declaration, Second Part.
That's a great point. Thank you for mentioning that. And I would agree with that, and I would maybe even sort of sharpen it, because the Bethel Confession really sort of was trying to get a much broader theological understanding of the issues that were at hand in what was happening in Nazi Germany. And the phrase that they took out was one, in Germany, it's actually, it's theological anti-Semitism, was that phrase. I mean, there's no other document where that phrase appears. It's a very strong phrase about, you know, this, the new ideology representing a form of theological anti-Semitism. Very radical. And, you know, Bauman really needs to be seen, I think, in a sense as a, you know, as a peace agreement. sort of a negotiated, you know, here's the big umbrella under which we can all stand. And that's where, you know, the more conservative members of the Bethel planning team, if you will, pushed the Bethel Confession. And that's where Bonhoeffer felt that it had lost its use theologically, because if it was just going to end up being something that people could live with, then it wasn't going to be of any use. And Bauman was very much, on one level, something that everybody could live with. But I think Bart, it does have a radical potential. I mean, that's, and I think that Bart really looked to that. So it did have an edge. It's just that, you know, you could overlook it if you wanted to. Yeah.
Are there any works, or is there any, did Bonhoeffer comment at all about his relationship with Niebuhr and in regards to pacifism? Hmm. Or moral man and moral society, Christian realism?
I'm not aware of that. The place where that would have happened, but I'm trying to think if it's in there, is 1939 when he was back in this country, and when he wrote Protestantism Without Reformation. But his diary in 1939 when he was in New York includes a list of all the different things he was reading. And little notes about what he was reading, so you can kind of see what he was looking at that point. But I don't think he specifically dealt with the issue of pacifism or
that. And maybe rightly so, that Bonhoeffer became a Christian realist around 1938. I'm putting words in your mouth. Maybe that's what I think, too. But you know, and particularly the adoption of responsibility, and yet Bonhoeffer doesn't, as far as I know, comment on Niebuhr's theology at that point. He has some more snarky things to say about American theology again in 39.
Well, but he also has an appreciation. I don't remember in that essay, though, that. Yeah, I'd have to actually go back and look.
Levin may be a good resource on that.
He could be, yeah.
Robin Levin is an American sort of Niebuhrian scholar who's been widely involved with her. We had him here a couple of years ago. Can I just ask one question? Any questions from our distinguished guests? No?
We're still learning.
Yes, you as well.
Well, I have two questions.
And this will have to be it, and then we can have a few minutes to exchange, please.
Well, when do you think she was thinking of getting out of the church?
Mm-hmm. Say that again?
What do you think Bonhoeffer wanted to learn or get out of the church?
Yeah. Yeah. I think at that point he was really looking at nonviolence as perhaps a possible tactic for the churches in Nazi Germany to follow. I mean, I think there was sort of a genuine interest in that. I think, you know, he assessed, in my opinion, rightly, that there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell of the churches in Germany doing that. And, you know, it seems like his own, he either lost steam on the issue or got sort of overwhelmed by other things. This was 34, yeah.
There's also a remarkable comment in a letter around that time, when Bonhoeffer wonders, and this is not 1943, he doesn't wonder. He contends that Western Christendom has run aground, and the renewal of Christianity will depend on the renewal of Christianity in places such as I was so amazed when I saw that letter from 30 to 34. So it's already a sense, you know, even before, you know, the German Christian Church has Church of Germany is in ruins, that he's seen a certain kind of weariness with Western forms of Christianity and longing for a greater cloud of witnesses, as he thought that, as he said once or twice in his letters.
And I think some of that actually starts in the 1920s with his dissertation. That, I mean, it's interesting, the phrase world come of age actually appears, I think, for the first time in 1932. So it's before the Nazis come to power. But I think that for him it was sort of the post-Enlightenment, post-industrial revolution. I mean, he was looking at the forces of industrialization and secularism and modernity in Europe that were already at sway, and feeling that there was something, a kind of spirituality that had been lost in his churches. And, you know, looking to people like Gandhi, or I think his experience in this country, in the African-American church, you know, he was encountering this elsewhere and thinking, so how could we get that back in Germany? Why study Bible? Well, great question. Why does it matter? Well, you don't have to, certainly. You can move on after this course. I think he's really interesting, and I think he's interesting in part because I think there are things that we could still find out about him, and you know, ways in which perceptions of him would shift. But that's also true of Karl Marx. That's also true of George Washington. I mean, you know, I think, you know, it depends on, you know, what you're looking for. I think for Christians, you know, for people who come out of the Christian faith, there really is something almost unique there. And that's one reason that for somebody coming out of Christianity, I think he's a great person to look at. Did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. To assassinate
yeah.
Hitler. How was that resolved?
Yeah. Well, that's the question people still argue about. In fact, that's the point of this new book that I keep mentioning, is that they are not able to reconcile it, and then they end up by saying, well, but he really wasn't the resistance. I think that his pacifism, number one, was a pacifism that could be best described as an anti-war pacifism, not as sort of the principled nonviolence you find in the Quakers. In fact, this is one of the really interesting things in looking at the Quakers I was looking at, because Bonhoeffer had the opportunity in Berlin in 1933 to really throw his lot in with the Quakers. They were there. They were really active. They were really anti-Nazi. They were doing the right thing. You know, that he wasn't in touch with them. That wasn't where he was coming from, but he was very anti-war. In terms of the resistance, you know, he ends up in the resistance by accident. I mean, he gets into the resistance because he doesn't want to serve in Hitler's army. He wants an exemption from the draft. There's a member of his family who's able to get that for him by giving him an assignment in the military counterintelligence office. And that becomes sort of his desk job for the resistance, if you will. So it's you know, not it's certainly not part of the inner core of people who are actually going to set the bombs or whatever. That being said, you know, the family accounts and the accounts of people like George Beall are that he did agree with the aims of the resistance, including the fact that they thought the killing of Hitler and the leading Nazis was going to be a necessary evil. Baker says that when Bonhoeffer, in supporting this, did not pretend to claim that this was the Christian thing to do. He didn't want to claim the sanction of his church for it because he understood how dangerous that would be. But he saw this as an exceptional case. There's an interesting lecture he gives to his students in 1935 in Finkenwalde on the topic of tyrannicide. And what he says in that lecture is that, you know, a tyrant is not just a person, an authority figure you don't like. I mean, there's a definition there. A tyrant is somebody who has exceeded the legitimate bounds of his authority and is acting in a way that really causes damage to the body politic, to the, you know, governance under his authority. And in those cases that there is a Christian tradition, sort of a just warlike tradition, that tyrannicide may be a legitimate option. But it's very carefully framed as an exceptional case. And one for which, you know, this dovetails with his writings in ethics, one for which, you know, you have to accept responsibility. You can't sort of say, you know, this is what the Ten Commandments teaches us. You say, this is, you know, here I stand. And that's how Bonhoeffer understood it. So, you know, it was a radical act, if you will, but one that he very, very carefully kind of set parameters around, precisely because he didn't want sort of this, you know, sense that, you know, this had larger sanction or greater implications, you know.
That's terrific. That's a great way to start right
here. Okay.
You have had a long day. You've given us so much.
You're welcome.
Amazing.